to this seminar, philosophical seminar, which is covering the issues of substance and shadow, which is a fundamental theme in Vedic philosophy, Vaishnava philosophy. So I have to say that I'm a bit sick since yesterday. I have a cold, fever, and my voice is in not such good shape, so you please bear with me. But we shall proceed from where we left off yesterday. Yesterday we said that we will now begin to discuss anuman, or reason, or logic. So anuman is the second of three pramans, or sources of valid evidence. These three, again, are pratyaksha, or sense perception, and again, anuman, our thinking, and ultimately, shabda, or the testimony of guru, shastra, sadhu. So we have repeatedly said that while these three are there, they are not equal. It is not that shabda can be surpassed or can be replaced by the other two. Shabda is always paramount. It is always transcendental. It determines the value of what we think and what we perceive. Whereas in other systems, non-Vedic materialistic systems, these three can be seen, but you will find either perception, such as in the system of empiricism, or today we'll be talking about rationalism as another system of philosophy. So in that system, anuman or speculation is the supreme evidence. So first, by way of introduction, when we speak of anuman, we're speaking of logic, logical thinking. This word logic we understand to mean thought which is reasonable, thought which is not deranged. Like when Srila Prabhupada came to New York in the middle 60s, 65, 66. So he was invited to attend some function in which there were many young people gathering. So Prabhupada was very eager for the opportunity to preach. So he would go to many strange functions, which later on he would never think of attending. So at one such early function, there was a music group performing on stage. And the musicians were dressed up as bananas. So it was four or five bananas standing there playing guitars. And Prabhupada found this very amusing. He was later on asking, after he returned to the center, Matchless Gifts, he was asking his early followers, trying to understand what is the meaning. Why were they dressed up, Prabhupada said, as plantains? And as he was asking this question, he practically collapsed in laughter. Because it was so ridiculous. So, the type of thought process that results in something like this, where people are dressing up as bananas and playing music, they were singing some song in celebration of smoking banana peels. There was a period in the hippie culture where it was thought that if you scrape the inside of a banana and dry it and smoke it, that will be hallucinogenic. Don't try it. It doesn't work anyway. But they thought like that. So the whole thing was absurd. So this is not logical thinking. This is deranged thinking. So logical thinking means something that is systematic. And it comes, the word logic, comes from an ancient Greek word, logos. So this word logos conveys the idea that the world is structured. The world is structured. Similarly, speech, our speech is structured. Therefore, you can understand what I'm saying. If I was just making some babbling noises, goo goo gaga like a child, then you would all get up and walk out. Because there's nothing here for you to learn if I talk in that way. So the world is structured, similarly speech is structured, human speech. So human thought, proper human thought, should similarly be structured. This is the idea of logos, from which we get the word logic. So now, a question can be raised, since we've been talking in the last couple days, about how pratyaksha, our perception of this world, ultimately, it's very paradoxical. We have been explaining how there are so many paradoxes in perception. It, because our senses are imperfect. And anyway, whatever we're receiving with these senses, that is only a signal or a slight hint of some reality beyond. It is not the full spectrum of experience of the absolute truth. Certainly not. And then that in itself, what we are receiving, is furthermore imperfect in so many ways. So, therefore one can, on the basis of this, of the problems of sense perception, he can ask the question, so is anything really logical then? Since this world seems to be nothing more than a big hallucination. And as I was saying, even big scientists like Einstein, they admit that our thoughts about this world, what this world means, they're totally arbitrary. Of course, we're talking about it in the realm of material science and philosophy. I can have my idea of what this means that I'm perceiving. You can have your idea, and they can be completely opposite. As a matter of fact, coexisting in science today are many theories which are completely incompatible. Scientists like to present science as being a very complete whole of knowledge, everything fitting together so nicely, but actually it is not like that. The theory of Newton, classical physics, and the theory of relativity of Einstein are incompatible. And yet both of them are used in science. And there are many, many other examples that can be given. So therefore, again, one could say, one could ask this question, well, how do we know that anything is, that things are really logical? Maybe logic is just an attempt of our mind to put something together which really doesn't make any sense. The world is just a big absurdity, and with our little human minds, we're trying to make sense out of it, but it is hopeless. And this so-called sense that we have of the world is just illusion. So, but the thing is that this word, logos, coming from ancient Greek culture, actually, it had a transcendental sense. There's this phrase I give in the book, logos spermaticus. this is a ancient Greek term, that matter, the material world, is in itself passive and shapeless. And this corresponds very well with our Vedic understanding, which is presented in the Srimad Bhagavatam. That this material nature by itself cannot assume form. It cannot create, maintain, or destroy anything. It is simply dull, ignorant energy, material energy. So, how is it that matter assumes form and becomes dynamic? That is because, as we know from the Srimad Bhagavatam, that it is pervaded, it is injected with spiritual energy by Lord Krishna's glance. So similarly, the ancient Greeks, they had this idea, logos spermaticos. Spermaticos means seeds. So there are seeds of reason, seeds of consciousness, which are injected into this matter. And thus, matter takes shape, form, direction. So these, the Vedic idea and this ancient Greek idea are parallel. And this word logos also means a divine word. Those seeds of reason were implanted into nature by a word, a spoken word. So Lord Krishna, he glances over material nature, injects the spirit souls into it, and thus material nature assumes form, and simultaneously with the injection of these effulgent spiritual sparks into material nature, there is an accompanying sound. And what is that sound? Om. All right, Om is all right.
Krishna's flute.
Huh?
Krishna's flute. The sound.
Yes, these are all, but
Veda.
What is, yes, Veda. The sound is known as Veda. Veda means knowledge. So Veda is actually the design, the subtle design by which this material cosmos takes its form. It is all enunciated by the Lord, spoken and recorded in the Vedic scriptures. So in Sanskrit, the word logic means anvikshiki. You'll find in the Bhagavatam that anvikshika, or the original logic, is taught by Brahma at the time of creation. And also we have a quotation from Bhagavatam which states that the logic of this material world is that the meaning of everything, the ultimate meaning of everything, the ultimate purpose of everything is simply to develop attraction to Krishna. This is actually, in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, the ultimate truth, the ultimate sense of everything, the ultimate purpose of human life is to develop attraction to Krishna. So Bhagavatam says, yes, this is the purpose of the universe. This is the logic of everything. So, if then logic is something that is given in the beginning, logic is the actual reason behind everything, then real logic is transcendental. It is descending. It is coming down from God. So, I'm explaining all this because sometimes, in course of preaching, we meet people, so-called intellectual people, and they try to challenge us that what you're saying is not logical. But no, I want everyone here to understand what is the original meaning of logic. The original meaning, logos, logic, or anvikshiki, is The actual original design by which this creation has unfolded, and that design is given by God. So, therefore, our logic, as Prabhupada says, I've quoted him, our logic that we use in Krishna consciousness, it is a kind of logic called deductive logic. And this is this is very valid and well understood in the world of philosophy, deductive logic. But you just simply have to, you know, if someone challenges you, you're not being logical, you have to know how to reply. Yes, we are logical. We follow deductive logic. And deductive logic, in most simple terms, is that knowledge, that explanation, which is given by an authority, which cannot be achieved by our senses and by our own independent speculation. I've given an example in my book, a very simple example, which you can well appreciate because you're here in the Gurukul. So I have I have a hut that I live in. So imagine I'm sitting in my hut inside, and I hear outside some strange sound. Now, my power of sight is blocked by the walls of the hut. And let's say this strange sound, I say in the book that it sounds like an ostrich. So an ostrich, it's a big bird, and it can be quite dangerous. So it doesn't have to be an ostrich. It could be the sound of a tiger or something. But there's some danger associated with this sound. So therefore, I'm reluctant to go outside and see what it is. Could be dangerous. So I cannot see what it is, and I will not go outside to investigate. So how can I know? How can I know what that sound really is? It's not... I can speculate. I can think, well, maybe it's a real ostrich, or maybe it's just a boy, one of these Gurukul boys, who's making a sound like an ostrich. Or maybe I'm dreaming. Maybe I'm asleep and dreaming. Actually, in these examples, these are different kinds of philosophies that people resort to. But I go on to say that if Bhaktivedya Purnaswami, who's the headmaster here, if he comes in from the outside to my hut, I can ask him, what's that, Maharaj? What is that strange sound outside? So he's the authority of the school. He knows all these boys and what they do. So he can tell me, oh, it is so-and-so Das from Australia. And he likes to make funny sounds. So now he's making the sound of an ostrich. And so I'm satisfied. I can ask him all kinds of questions. This is not blind faith. Because I can ask him all kinds of questions. Who is this boy? What does he look like? And so on and so forth. I can get all of my questions satisfied just by asking Maharaj. So this is deductive logic. Turning to an authority. I give another example. Just like if you have a computer. So a computer is a very complex device. So your computer may stop functioning. Now there's certain things that we know how to do if a computer stops functioning. For instance, you can check if it's plugged in. Maybe the battery's dead and it needs to be plugged in the mains. And you do that if it comes on. Then your guess, your trial and error logic, this is called inductive logic. So it has been validated. But sometimes whatever you do, the computer still doesn't work. So then, what is our only recourse? If you don't know anything about computers and you take a screwdriver and you open up the back and start to fiddle around, you'll probably destroy the whole thing. So what do we do in that case? We go to an expert. We go to the computer repair shop. and they take care of the problem. So again, this is deductive logic. And this has been for a long, long time, until very recently, and by recently I mean the past few hundred years, deductive logic, both in India and also in the West, was considered the actual real logic, valid logic. That you accept the authoritative explanation from a master, spiritual master, or some master of whatever kind of knowledge we may be concerned with. But I also point out that in the West, this deductive logic, because it was not based on Guru, Shastra, Sadhu, so it was imperfect. It was actually commonplace, laukika, not transcendental. Like Aristotle. Aristotle is one of the great authorities, so to speak, in the history of philosophy. But Aristotle, so he taught a whole complete philosophical system. But later on, Europeans, in examining this system, they found things like, for instance, Aristotle says that men have more teeth than women. So Aristotle is giving so many speculative explanations of metaphysics and this and that, which the medieval church was accepting lock, stock, and barrel. But then some early, you know, skeptical thinkers, the early scientists, they began to look and they said, wait a minute. He says, men have more teeth than women. And then they would turn to their wife, open your mouth. And they would count. And they'd look in a mirror, count. No, men and women have the same amount of teeth. So why is he saying this? Something's wrong. So as soon as they found a defect, then doubts began to grow. And this is actually how in the West, gradually, the deductive logic was superseded by inductive logic. An inductive logic is that you guess a transcendent conclusion based upon your observations. And there's an example from another book that I've quoted in this book of crows. So, or actually I think it's blackbirds, because sometimes crows are different colors. But a blackbird is obviously a black bird. Well, there's a species of bird called a blackbird. So every blackbird that we have seen is black. So if then I generalize on the basis of that, that I've seen in my life 108 blackbirds, therefore I conclude that all blackbirds at all times, at all places, are black. This is induction. Because it just might happen after I've come to this conclusion, 5 minutes later, an albino blackbird appears in the tree. A blackbird that is white. And this then shoots holes in my theory. But this is how induction works. It is the logic of pratyaksha. The proof is sense perception. So this is laukika, or ordinary logic. It has its use up to a certain point. For instance, this is the logic that policemen use, detectives use, when they solve crimes. They come to a scene of a crime, and what do? They gather all the evidence very carefully, fingerprints and blood stains and this and that. And they take it back to the police laboratory and look at it in under microscopes and so on and so forth. And then they interview the various witnesses and suspects. And after putting all this data together, then the head detective, he begins to speculate inductively who is the perpetrator of the crime, who killed the millionaire. So the evidence may tend to implicate the butler. This is a very, you know, that's a common phrase, the butler did it. So then the butler, that becomes what is called the hypothesis. The detective thinks, it seems logical to me that the butler did it. And so then he begins to focus on this butler. They interrogate him very heavily. And they find out what he's been doing. They check his bank accounts. They go around and check out his family and friends. And if they find he's been putting money away for which there's no explanation, only that he must have been stealing it from his millionaire boss, then the doubts increase. And they begin to think, and the detective begins to think that, yes, it is the logical conclusion that he is the killer. And then he accuses him of the crime. So this is how induction works. But even if all the evidence supports that this butler has done the crime, even the evidence is so strong, and even the butler confesses, sometimes it happens, the butler, because he's so much under pressure, the police are interrogating him all night with the hot lights on him, and saying, look, we have this piece of evidence, and this person says that about you, and on and on and on. And he may break down and say, yes, I did it. Actually, in the Bolsheviks in Russia, some of you are from Russia, yes? So they had a nice interrogation technique. They just wouldn't let a person sleep. Just keep him awake. One whole 24 hours, 48 hours. So after 3, 4, 5 days of that, not being able to sleep for even a minute, a person is ready to confess to anything. So even he confesses. Even all the evidence is supporting the accusation. There are many instances where in the end it's found it's not true, he didn't do the crime. So this inductive process, because it is based, the proof is pratyaksha, it is never actually perfect. Sometimes it's right, yes. Sometimes it's right. But anyway, its rightness and wrongness, again, is only within the realm of sense perception, the material realm. So, inductive logic, we devotees also use it in so many ways. I give the example how Prabhupada asked in the very early days one of his disciples to go to the IBM company. And because IBM was giving typewriters to charitable organizations, that was their policy. So Prabhupada said, go there and say, we are doing the best welfare work. We are devotees of Krishna. This is like 1966. So nobody knew anything about ISKCON. But Prabhupada said, go there and preach to them and see if they will give you a typewriter. So this is kind of like induction. You don't really know what the outcome will be, but you just experiment. You just see. And so the devotee, he didn't get the typewriter. But devotional service is so nice that even for the endeavor, the sincere endeavor, you get credit. Because the actual result of our devotional activities is never material. The result is not the typewriter. The result is going out on the order of the spiritual master and trying to serve him and serve Krishna. And if we do that sincerely, then Krishna, he gives us acknowledgement, transcendental acknowledgement. He recognizes us as his devotee. So, yes, we also use inductive logic, but in determining what is the absolute truth, we do not depend on this type of logic. We depend on deductive logic, that which is handed down by authority. And that authority, of course, has to be infallible. So the Vedas are infallible, they're aparusheya, they're not composed by human beings. And one who is the proper representative of the Vedic knowledge, he is called, for example, there's a Sanskrit word, apta. Apta means that he has also transcended the material platform. He is situated in transcendental knowledge, Vedic knowledge. And he's speaking from the position of realization. This is guru. Guru and sadhu. So, in determining ultimate truths, we must rely upon deductive knowledge. Otherwise, we fall victim to speculation. So, then, someone may say, but I want to realize this truth for myself. So simply accepting formulas which are handed down by authority, then I just have to believe them. But how can I realize them? So there's another kind of logic, which in the West is called abductive logic, or which Prabhupada calls philosophical speculation. And Prabhupada gives a nice example. So you hear in the Shastra that Krishna is the taste of water. So you can just accept that Krishna is the taste of water. But also you can test that. You can test that. So Prabhupada said, when you drink water, you should speculate how this water is actually the taste of Krishna. And so by this type of introspective meditation, Krishna, he reveals himself, because this philosophical speculation is also part of devotional service. So in this way, we all can speculate. It's not that speculation is forbidden to us, but mental speculation is forbidden to us. Mental speculation means that type of speculation which is not founded in Guru, Shastra, Sadhu. So you can speculate, but according to the direction of Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. Yes?
May I ask a question?
Yes?
Sometimes we see that there's also another thing, like we have spiritual senses also, material senses and spiritual senses. And also in the West there's some saints who had got some vision, divine vision, and this and that. And also in our Sampradaya, somehow Mahaprabhu showed his six-armed form and this and that. This is more related to the spiritual senses, right? I mean, it is not a gross sense perception, it is more like another type of knowledge which is given by the divine source directly, isn't it?
Yes. This is, I've explained later on, that there are five stages of Vedic knowledge. And the ultimate stage is a prakrita, which means beyond prakriti, beyond material nature, nature altogether. So that is the spiritual world. The spiritual world is replete with transcendental forms, transcendental activities, transcendental reality. Now that can be revealed to us. Even those of us who are here in the material world, who are conditioned by material senses, by the Lord's grace, He can reveal transcendental reality to us. Actually, the Holy Name is that revelation. The Holy Name is always perfect and pure and transcendental, non-different from Krishna Himself. And as we cultivate the chanting of the Holy Name, then our experience of the Divine Name becomes richer and richer and richer, until finally we see at the Bhava stage that the Name and the Lord Himself are not different. The Name is Krishna, and you actually see Krishna.
So this is same as Shabda, somehow?
Yes. Shabda is the process of revelation. So, we've been talking about logic, and one point we have to understand is that while Lord Krishna, He, as we've just said, does reveal Himself, does allow Himself to be understood through our logical processes by the authorized way, we must always remember that Krishna, he's achintya. Achintya means that although he may reveal himself to our logical understanding, there's a nice example. It is like seeing the moon. It's called Shakachandranyaya. Like seeing the moon through the branches of a tree. So the teacher may say to the student, look at that tree, look at those branches. So the student, he can see the branches, so he's looking. And then he will gradually notice that the moon is rising up behind the branches. Oh, there is the moon. So the branches are like our logical speculation, our attempt by the mind to understand the statements of Scripture. We speculate, yes, and as I've just said, that's all right. As long as it is in accordance with the conclusions of Scripture, we discuss, we ask questions, that's all right. And in this way, our minds, they become drawn to Krishna logically. They progress, the mind progresses towards the conclusion that Krishna is everything. But Krishna, he's like the moon. So we can never say that the moon is captured within the branches of a tree. We can never say that. The mundane logicians, they try to do that. You see, they by word juggling. Just like if you say Krishna is the taste of water, they will say, oh, so you're saying Krishna is water. And you're just worshipping water. You see, they do these tricks of word juggling. But no. The moon, we understand, is millions and millions and millions of times greater than this tree. There's no way that the moon can be captured by the branches of the tree. But by looking at the branches of the tree, we can focus our minds on the moon. We get a fix. So this is the idea. Just like there is this statement in Brahma Sangita, Ekopiyasaura chayatam jagananda koti yatshakti rasti jagananda chayayananta andantara paramano chayantarastam govindamari purusham tamaham bhajami. So this verse is saying that the universes, all the universes, are somewhere within the being of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. There are some insignificant aspect of His total being, all the universes. And yet simultaneously, that same Supreme Being, Krishna, He is situated within every atom. Now, this defies our logical thoughts. This defies our mental speculation. You think about it and you're thinking, does that mean that within one atom, all the universes are existing? Am I inside of an atom right now? Yeah, you can think like that and become baffled. It's simply baffling because that is Krishna. He's a chincha. Ultimately, he's beyond our power to understand. But just as he, by his mercy, appears within the taste of water, or within the light of the sun and the moon, for those who have been awakened to see him in that way. So similarly, he does appear within our logical thought processes as directed by the scriptures. So, yes. So I want to conclude by saying that our Krishna consciousness process is therefore, while it is logic, it is not rationalism. This is a type of philosophy, rationalism, which says that, actually they have a theory of the truth. Their theory of the truth, it's called the coherence theory of truth. That everything that's true has to be understandable to the mind. And so we see in modern time, there are big famous physicists like this Stephen Hawking. How many have heard of him? Yes. So he and others, like Roger Penrose, another big mathematician, they're working on what they call the TOE, the theory of everything. See, they want to reduce the world down to a mathematical formula, which they hope can be printed on the front of a t-shirt. And this mathematical formula, you see, if you work it out, it will explain everything. It will explain, for example, why, as we're talking here, one butterfly will fly by. Or why one leaf will fall from a tree to the ground as we sit here. All conceit, the rationalist conceit, rationalism. And this we must understand. That Lord Krishna's, it is within Lord Krishna's mind that the absolute truth is displayed. And we, because our minds, our consciousness is derived from Krishna, we are expanded from Krishna. Therefore, yes, we can share. We can share to some degree that experience of the absolute truth, which is eternally and unlimitedly displayed in Lord Krishna's mind. We can share in that. But we are not Krishna. So, ultimately, as we see, even Lord Brahma, Srila Prabhupada said, Lord Brahma, with his four heads, he's the biggest brain in this universe. He's the biggest scientist. But ultimately, he was also baffled by Krishna. He tried to test, he tried to do an experiment, testing Krishna, testing his Hare Krishna. testing his position by stealing away the coward boys and the cows. And what was the result? That then later on, Krishna, he pulled back the curtain of Yoga Maya and let Brahma see him in all his mystic opulence. And Brahma was just completely baffled and fell on his face before the Lord. And he prayed to the Lord that there may be people who say that they understand you. Brahma's being a little sarcastic here, because he's the most intelligent person in the universe. So there may be people who say they understand you, but as far as I'm concerned, my dear Lord, I don't understand anything about you. So, by Krishna's grace, because our mind, our intelligence, our consciousness is derived from His, so therefore, yes, we can have some understanding of His glories, but not completely. So therefore we devotees are not rationalists. We do not expect to understand the length and the breadth and the full dimension of the Supreme Personality of God up here in our tiny little brain. But that is the conceit of the rationalist philosophers. And ultimately these rationalist philosophers, they're impersonalists. I explain this. Their idea is to bring all the phenomena, all of experience under one logical principle. And this is a monistic tendency. As soon as you try to bring everything under one theory, one formula on your t-shirt, this is monism. And ultimately, because they're so tiny, their brains are so tiny, and I actually quote from some modern philosopher. So they can only conceive of this absolute principle, all-inclusive principle, as something impersonal. You see, all of the details of creation, they think by their logic, can only be fit into an empty space, which will be the background foundation of everything. So I quote here, one big philosopher, modern philosopher, saying that what is being ultimately, it must be non-being. Being and non-being are the same. And Srila Prabhupada, then right after that, I quote Srila Prabhupada saying, this doesn't make any sense. Because how can all of these figures of creation, trees, human beings, birds, how can they emanate from something that is nothing, that is zero, that has no form, that has no quality? It doesn't make any sense. How can the energies of creation be managed by something that has no characteristics at all? No, not even a sense of its own existence. I also show the same paradox in Aristotle again, who proposed four kinds of causes. And these you'll find in Prabhupada's books: efficient cause, material cause, final cause, formal cause. Prabhupada uses these terms also. So very briefly, material cause means the ingredients, just like this grass hut is made out of bamboo and grass. So those are that's the material cause of this house, bamboo and grass. The formal cause is the purpose. Why does this have this form? Because we want to live in it. It has that shape, so that human beings can live inside of it. And then there's the efficient cause. The efficient cause is who put it together. There were workmen who assembled it. And what is the other one?
Final.
Final, I said, that's the purpose. Formal, efficient.
Remote material.
No, not remote cause. Material cause, I said, it's the ingredients. So, let's try to find this very quickly. Oh, yes, here, let's see. Material, formal. Oh, yes, I guess I said them all. Sorry. Okay, material, formal, efficient, and final cause. So, now, but according to Aristotle, the ultimate cause, or the ultimate truth, is something, again, which is a non-being, like an empty mind that only thinks of itself. You see? And somehow or other, out of this mind which thinks only of itself, not of this world, the world comes about. An impersonal, disembodied mind. But that doesn't make any sense. Let's be practical. Here's a thatch house. You ask me, oh, very nice. Who's responsible for this? Now what makes more sense? If I answer, yes, there is one person, Bhakti Vidyapurna Swami, who's in charge of this Gurukul. And he is the ultimate reason behind the efficient, material, final, formal causes of this. There's one person, one Maharaj. Or if I would say, oh, who is responsible for this? It is a disembodied mind. A disembodied mind that has no purpose at all. Has no even interest in the existence of this house. He doesn't care if it exists or not. But somehow out of this disembodied mind, this house came about. So what is more logical? Obviously the answer that there's a person behind this. So you see, this monistic, rationalistic logic, it ultimately becomes a paradox. It's just foolishness. So we are not rationalists. We are devotees of Krishna. We understand that ultimately the material cause, the source of the ingredients, the formal cause, the reason why these ingredients have been put together, the efficient cause, the powers by which these ingredients were put together, and the final, what is it? Material, formal, yes, final cause. Final cause is the reason. Formal cause means the design, that's right. Formal cause is the design. So final cause is the reason. So ultimately all these causes are taking place because of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And I've cited in this book a verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam in which actually those four causes are mentioned, and saying that Krishna, ultimately Krishna is the root of these four causes. That's from the sixth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. So that even the Sanskrit terms are given of these four kinds of causes.
Which chapter?
Let's find it here. Yes, Srimad Bhagavatam 6.9.42. So the upadana is the ingredient or material cause. Svarupena pradana rupena, the formal cause. Nimitta yamana, the efficient cause, the power by which everything is assembled. And artivishesha, the purpose behind creation. So these four causes are found in the Bhagavatam also. And Krishna is the source of each one. Yes?
Sometimes we see that maybe some person gets murdered or somebody, something like that. Then we say, oh, the murderer, he is the cause. But actually the past karma of this person was the cause that he has been murdered, you know, because he murdered somebody else in his previous life like that. So he got some reaction. Which cause is this, if some karmic reaction comes?
No, actually, his question is about karma. And he's asking, if someone in this life murders another person, he is accused. He'll be accused in the court of being the murderer. But he's asking, isn't it according to our philosophy that karma is the cause? That it's just his karma. But this is not a proper understanding of karma. Because in the human form of life, that type of explanation may be all right when we're talking about animals, lower forms of life, whose willpower is not so developed. They're completely under the control of their senses. But human beings, we have, as Prabhupada said, minute independence in this human form of life. So, karma creates a situation. Karma creates, for instance, for that murder, his karma has created a situation in which there is some person in his life who is causing him a great deal of problem. And that person is always disturbing him, and he can't get away from that person. And so he becomes obsessed in his mind what to do. And karma also offers the opportunity. Karma presents an opportunity. Well, here's a pistol in your desk. And it's a dark night and no one's around. And this person has really made you angry just now. Why don't you take the pistol out and shoot him in the head? That opportunity is also presented by karma. But it is his choice. His choice as a human being that he takes that opportunity. You see? So it is also, there are also other choices he could have taken besides that. So that is why in the human form of life we are responsible. We cannot just say, karma made me do it, or the devil made me do it, or something like that. We are responsible.
And if that person would not have murdered him, he would have died anyway by his karma then? In some other way?
No, in the human form of life there is free will. You take that person's life. He wasn't supposed to die. He wasn't supposed to die. But you have that act, you have taken away his life, and therefore you will be punished. See? Yes? Oh, okay.
Because logic, this formal material logic, this sentence, which is very subtle and seems to be transcendental logic, is there some some simple criteria or characteristics by which we can distinguish very clearly which is transcendental logic, which is just formal?
The transcendental logic is that which is handed down by authority, Guru, Shastra, Sadhu. That is the explanation I give of some quotations from Prabhupada on the same point. He's explaining this. This is deductive logic. And now, the laukika or ordinary logic. It can also be deductive in the sense that there's some authority, but that authority, he's just a common man. He's a laukika person. He's assuming the position of a teacher. So in that sense, it's deductive. But ultimately, the source is ordinary. And therefore, it's defective. So this would just be another variety of material logic. The actual deductive, the truly deductive logic, is that which is coming down from the transcendental platform. Mm-hmm. Yes?
In which place of Vedic philosophy, the method of dialectic can be placed? The method of dialectic means...
Yes, method of dialectic. Dialectic means... what is it? Thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. So you find that in Isopanishad, for example. Thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. There it is stated that the demigod worships, the worshippers, they enter into darkness. Then it goes on to say the worshippers of the impersonal absolute, which is the antithesis, they enter into even worse darkness. So only one who understands the source of everything, the source of the demigods, and the source of the impersonal absolute, only he is in knowledge. This, I'm just paraphrasing what the Isopanishad is saying. And so that is the synthesis. See, between karmis and jnanis, there is this division. And you find, I in the third chapter of this book, I explain that, quoting from Srila Prabhupada. The karmis and jnanis can never get along. One is the thesis, this world is real, and the other is the antithesis, this world is unreal. And they can never get along. So, Srila Prabhupada is saying both positions are wrong. Both positions are wrong. There is actually a synthesis. When we understand that this world has come from a personal source, it is temporary, so in that sense you cannot accept it as real, meaning eternal. But on the other side, it is real in the sense that it really comes from Krishna. So this is the actual synthesis. But it's a transcendental synthesis. It's not a synthesis like they try in the material world of taking two opposite positions and somehow sticking them together. That won't work. One has to go above to the source. And then everything is synthesized. Because the Bhagavatam says that Krishna, he resolves all contradictions. This world is full of contradictions. You can never resolve them separately from Krishna. But because he's the source, he resolves them all. Okay. We're over time. I just want everyone to know.
Concerning Shabda, since we are not authorities ourselves, how are we to determine what is a valid or absolute authority?
So he's asking, since we are not authorities ourselves, how do we determine who is an authority? Who is the authoritative source of Shabda? So, well, that I want to speak about Shabda tomorrow and the five stages of Vedic knowledge. And then these questions will be answered. Yes?
Maharaj, in Anumana we understood about deductive and other... So deductive comes in Shabda or in Anumana?
Well, deductive logic, because it's logic, it is Anuman, but it is Shastra Mulaka, that's a term. It is rooted in Shastra. It is a thought process, it is Anuman, but its root, its mula, is in Shastra. You never, you know, detach your thoughts from Shastra. This is our Vedic Vaishnava logic. You understand?
Deductive logic comes in
Shabda Praman? No, we're counting it as Anuman Praman. Just like, especially, this what Prabhupada called philosophical speculation. That we accept on the statement of Shastra that Krishna is the taste of water. We accept that. And so when we drink water, this is a very simple example, then you are free to speculate how that's true. And you have realizations. Actually, Krishna is revealing himself through your speculation. Because this is in line. This is in line with the statement of Shastra. So Krishna will therefore enter your thoughts. And you will realize Krishna through your thoughts. So this is Anuman, but it is Anuman that brings us to transcendence. And then if we think separately, you know, in a way that defies, that challenges, that opposes the Shastra, then this is totally materialistic Anuman, useless. That's just mental speculation. Yes? Well, yes, I mean in the sense that you have to certainly use your mind to comprehend what is being taught there. But the same as of the Bhagavad Gita or anything, we have to use our mind in order to comprehend what is being presented in the Shastra. So, again, this brings us back to this point. Just like there is Shastra Shakshush, this is Pratyaksha. This is seeing but through the eyes of Scripture. So this is Pratyaksha and Anuman, which is harmonious with the Shabda. So therefore, actually what you've also suggested is right, because Prabhupada also said, when someone asked him, what about the Pramans? And he wanted to get into a whole complicated discussion about different Pramans. And Prabhupada said, there's only one Praman, Shabda Praman. Even though other times we know Prabhupada says there's three Pramans. So it's true. We can all say that Shastra Shakshush, we can say Shastra Shakshush is Shabda Praman. And this type of philosophical reasoning, which is harmonious with the Shastra, that's also Shabda Praman. You could say that. But still, there is the use of perception and logic within the Shabda. Alright, so I thank you very much for attending, and I thank you also for bearing with me. It's been a little hard today because I'm sick. So tomorrow we'll meet again, 11 o'clock here, and we'll wrap up this seminar by discussing the Shabda Praman. Hare Krishna. Hare. See you tomorrow.
Jai Swami Maharaj ki.
Jai.